Let her pass, Beata ordered.
Yes, Sergeant.
Fitch threw up his arms, looking suddenly terrified.
Beata, what are you doing? You want to get me killed? She's crazy. The woman is a monster.
We'll have a talk with her. Don't worry. We'll not let the little boy get hurt. We'll find out what she wants and take care of it. Fitch looked hurt. That did not displease Beata, not after all the trouble he was causing, after he stole something as valuable as the Sword of Truth, a valuable thing of magic. Now the fool boy had gone and got his friend Morley involved in thieving and got him killed for it. And to think, she once thought she could fall in love with Fitch. He hung his head.
Beata, I'm sorry. I just wanted to make you proud.
Thieving is not something to be proud of, Fitch.
You just don't understand,
he muttered, on the verge of tears.
You just don't understand.
Beata heard an odd ruckus from the next Dominie Dirch. Shouts and such, but no alarm. As she turned to look, she saw the three special Andereth guards trotting in on their horses, the ones Estelle had spotted. She wondered what they would want. She turned to the sound of the galloping horse coming in. Beata jabbed a finger against Fitch's chest.
Now you just keep quiet and let me do the talking.
Rather than answer, he stared at the ground. Beata turned and saw the horse race past the stone base. The woman was indeed wearing red. Beata had never seen anything like it, a red leather outfit from head to toe. Her long blonde braid was flying out behind. Beata's guard went up. She had never seen a look of determination such as was on this woman's face. She didn't even bother to halt her horse. She simply dove off it at Fitch. Beata shoved Fitch out of the way. The woman rolled twice and came up on her feet.
Hold on, Beata cried. I told him we'd settle this with you and he'd give you back what's yours.
Beata was baffled to see that the woman held a black bottle by its neck. To dive off a horse with a bottle. Maybe Fitch was right. Maybe she was crazy. She didn't look crazy, but she did look resolved to carry this matter into the next world if she had to. The woman, her sky-blue eyes fixed on Fitch, ignored Beata.
Give it over now, and I'll not kill you. I'll only make you regret being born.
Fitch, instead of giving up, drew the sword. It made a ring of steel such as Beata, used to the sound of blades, had never heard. Fitch got a strange look on his face. His eyes were going wide, like he might faint or something. His eyes had a decidedly strange look in them, a shimmering light that gave Beata goose flesh. It was a look of some kind of awesome inner vision. The woman held the bottle out in one hand like it was a weapon. With her other hand, she waggled her fingers, taunting Fitch to come closer, to attack her. Beata stepped in to restrain the woman until they could talk it over. Beata next realized she was sitting on the ground, her face stung something fierce.
Stay out of it, the woman said in a voice like ice. There is no need for you to be hurt. Do yourself a favor and stay down.
Her blue eyes turned to Fitch.
Come on, boy. Either give it up or do something about it.
Fitch did something about it. He swung the sword. Beata could hear the tip whistle going through the air. The woman danced back a step and at the same time thrust with the black bottle. The sword shattered it into a thousand pieces that filled the air like a storm cloud.
Ha!
The woman cried in triumph. She grinned wickedly.
Now I'll take the sword.
She flicked her wrist. When she did, a red leather rod hanging on a gold chain at her wrist spun up into her hand. At first she looked expectantly overjoyed, but the look turned to confusion and then to bafflement as she stared at the thing in her hand.
It should work, she mumbled to herself. It should work.
When she looked up, she saw something that brought her back to her senses. Beata glanced over but didn't see anything odd. The woman seized Beata's outfit at the shoulder and hauled her to her feet.
Get your people out of here. Get them out now.
What? Fitch is right. You are.
She thrust her arm out, pointing.
Look, you fool.
The special Andereth guards were coming toward them, chatting among themselves.
Those are our men. They're nothing to worry.
Get your people out of here right now, or you will all die.
Beata huffed at being ordered about by some crazy woman, treating her like a child. She called over to Corporal Marie Favelle, not 20 feet away, as she was walking out to see what the commotion was all about.
Corporal Favelle, Beata called out.
Yes, Sergeant,
the Ander woman asked. Have those men wait there until we get this settled.
Beata put her fists on her hips as she turned to the woman in red.
Satisfied?
The woman ground her teeth and grabbed Beata's shoulder again.
You little fool! Get you and your other children moving right now, or you will all die!
Beata was getting angry.
I'm an officer in the Andereth army, and those men...
Beata turned to point. Marie Favelle stepped in front of the men, held up a hand, and told them they would have to wait. One of the three unceremoniously drew his sword and swung it with a casual but frightening power. Accompanied by the sickening thwack of blade hitting bone, it cut Marie clean in half. Beata stood stupefied, not really believing what she was seeing. Working for a butcher, she'd seen so much slaughtering, it hardly ever warranted a second look. She'd cleaned the guts from so many different animals that seeing guts seemed to her just a natural thing. Guts didn't appall Beata in the least. Seeing Marie there on the ground, with her guts spilling out of her top half, in one way seemed only a curiosity. A human animal's guts so similar to other animals, but human. Marie Favelle, separated from her hips and legs, gasped, clutching at the grass, her eyes wide as her brain tried to comprehend the shock of what had just happened to her body. It was so dauntingly horrifying, Beata couldn't move. Marie pulled at the grass, trying to drag herself away from the men toward Beata. Her lips moved, but no words came out, just low, hoarse grunts. Her fingers lost their power. She slumped, twitching like a freshly butchered sheep. Up on the Dominie Dirch, both Estelle and Emmeline screamed. Beata pulled free her sword, holding it aloft for all to see. "Soldiers, attack!" Beata checked the men. They were still coming. They were grinning. And then the world turned truly mad. Chapter 64 Norris rushed forward like they'd been trained, going for the legs of one man. The man kicked Norris in the face. Norris fell back, holding his face, blood running out through his fingers. The man picked up Norris's fallen sword and plunged it through his gut, pinning Norris to the ground, leaving him to squirm in screaming agony to shred his fingers on the sharp blade. Carl and Bryce were rushing in with weapons drawn. Corrine charged out of the barracks with a spear. Annette was right behind her with another. Beata felt a surge of conviction. The men were going to be surrounded. Her soldiers were trained for combat. They could handle three men. "Sergeant!" the woman in red called. "Get back!" Beata was terrified, but she still felt annoyed by the woman, who obviously didn't know the first thing about soldiering. Beata was also ashamed for the woman's cowardice. Beata and her soldiers would stand and fight. They would protect the worthless woman in red, who feared to stand up to a mere three of the enemy. Fitch, too, Beata was proud to note, rushed forward with his prized sword ready to fight. As they all rushed in, only the man who had cut down Marie even had his sword out. The other two still had their weapons sheathed. She was furious that they would take Beata's squad so lightly. Beata, better accustomed to stabbing meat with a blade than were the rest of her squad, confidently went for a man. She didn't see how, but he effortlessly dodged her. Startled, she realized that this was not at all like stabbing straw men or carcasses hanging from a hook. As Beata's blade caught only air, Annette rushed up to stab him in the leg from behind. He sidestepped Annette, too, but caught her by her red hair. He pulled a knife, and in an easy, slow manner, as he smiled wickedly into Beata's eyes, slit Annette's throat as if he were butchering a hog. Another man caught Corrine's spear, snapped it in half with one hand, and rammed the barbed point in her gut. Carl swung his sword low at the man Beata missed, trying to hamstring him, and got his face kicked instead. The man swung his sword down at Carl. Beata sprang forward and blocked his strike. The power of the ringing blow of steel against steel hammered her weapon from her hand. Her hand stung so much she couldn't flex her unfeeling fingers. She realized she was on her knees. The man swung down on Carl. Carl held his hands up protectively before his face. The sword severed his hands at mid-palm before it split his face to his chin. The man turned back to Beata. His blood-slicked sword was coming for her face next. Seeing it coming, Beata could do nothing but scream. A hand snatched her hair and violently yanked her back. The sword tip whistled right past her face, hitting the ground between her legs. It was the woman in red who had just saved Beata's life. The man's attention was caught by something else. He turned to look. Beata looked too and saw riders coming, maybe as many as 100. More special Andorth guards, just like these three. The woman in red pulled Bryce back just before he was killed. As soon as she turned to something else, he rushed back at the enemy despite her orders to stay back. Beata saw a sword, the blade red, erupt from the middle of Bryce's back, lifting him from his feet. The big man who had hacked Carl now turned his attention back to Beata. She tried to scurry back, but his long stride was faster. In her panic, she couldn't get her feet. Beata knew she was going to die. As the sword swung down on her, she couldn't think what to do. She began a prayer she knew she wouldn't get a chance to finish. Fitch leaped in front of her, his sword blocking the killing blow. The enemy's blade shattered on Fitch's weapon. Beata blinked in surprise. She was still alive. Fitch took a fierce swing at the man. He sidestepped, Fitch's blade just missing his middle as he arched his back. With an icy efficiency as the blade was going by him, the man casually unhooked the spiked mace from a hanger on his weapons belt. As Fitch was still whipping around with the momentum, the man took a swift, powerful, backhanded swing. The blow tore off the top of Fitch's skull. Pink chunks of his brains splattered up Beata's tunic. Fitch crumbled to the ground. Beata sat frozen in shock. She could hear her own cries, like a panicked child. She couldn't make herself stop. It was like she was watching someone else. Instead of killing her, the man turned his consideration to Fitch, or rather, Fitch's sword. He pulled the gleaming weapon from Fitch's limp hand, and then yanked the baldric and scabbard free of the dead weight of the body. More mounted men were just arriving as the man slid the Sword of Truth back into the scabbard. He smiled and winked at Beata.
"I think Commander Stein would like to have this. What do you think?"
Beata sat stunned, Fitch's body right in front of her, his brains all over her, his blood emptying out on the ground.
"Why?"
was all Beata could say. The man was still grinning.
"Now that you all had your chance to vote, Emperor Jigang is casting the deciding ballot."
"What you got here?" another man called as he dismounted. "Some decent-looking girls." "Well, don't kill them all," the man complained good-naturedly. "I like mine warm and still moving."
The men all laughed. Beata whimpered as she pushed with her heels, scooting away from the men.
"This sword is something I've heard of. I'm taking it to Commander Stein. He'll be pleased no end to be able to present it to the Emperor."
Over her shoulder, she saw another man up on the Dominie Dirch casually disarm Estelle and Emmeline as they tried to defend their post. Emmeline leaped from the Dominie Dirch to escape. The fall broke her leg. A man on the ground grabbed her red hair in his fist and started dragging her toward the barracks as if he had caught a chicken. Estelle was getting kissed by the man up on the Dominie Dirch as she beat her fists against him. The men thought her battling comical. Men in dark leather plates and belts and straps covered with spikes and chain mail and fur and with massive swords, flails, and axes were dismounting everywhere. Others, still on their horses, were racing around and around at the Dominie Dirch, cheering. When the men all turned to Emmeline's renewed screams of pain and terror and to her captors laughing, a hand snatched Beata's collar and dragged her back on her bottom. The woman in red leather behind her growled under her breath,
"Move, while you still can."
Beata, powered by panic, scrambled up and ran with the woman while the men weren't looking. The two of them dove into a dip in the ground hidden by the tall grass.
"Stop that crying,"
the woman ordered.
"Stop it, or you'll get us caught."
Beata forced herself to stop making noise, but she couldn't stop the tears. Her whole squad had just been killed, except Estelle and Emmeline, and they were captured. Fitch, that fool Fitch, had just gotten himself killed, saving her life.
"If you don't hush, I'll slit your throat myself."
Beata bit her lip. She had always been able to keep herself from crying. It had never been this hard.
"I'm sorry,"
Beata whispered in a whine.
"I just saved your fat from the fire. In return, you can at least not get us caught."
The woman watched as the man with the Sword of Truth galloped away, back toward Fairfield. She cursed under her breath.
"Why'd you just drag me away?"
Beata asked in bitter anger.
"Why didn't you at least try to get some of them?"
The woman flicked out a hand.
"Who do you think did that? Who do you think was protecting your back? One of your children's soldiers?"
Beata looked then and saw what she hadn't seen before. Dead enemy soldiers sprawled here and there. She looked back to the woman's blue eyes.
"Idiot,"
the woman muttered.
"You act like this is my fault, like you hate me." "Because you are a fool."
She pointed angrily out at the carnage.
3 men just wiped out your post, and they aren't even breathing hard."
"But they surprised us."
"You think this some game? You're not even smart enough to realize you're nothing more than a dupe. Those in charge puffed you up with false courage and sent you out to fail. It's plain as day, and you can't even see it. 100 of you girls and boys couldn't knock down one of those men. Those are Imperial Order troops."
"But if they just..."
"You think the enemy is going to play by your rules? Real life just got those other young people killed, and the dead girls are going to be better off than the ones still alive, I can promise you that."
Beata was so horrified she couldn't speak. The woman's heated voice softened a little.
"Well, it's not all your fault. I guess you aren't old enough to know better, to know some of life's realities. You can't be expected to see what's true and not. You only think you can.
Why do you want that sword so bad?
Because it belongs to Lord Rawl. He sent me to get it.
Why'd you save me?
The woman stared back at her. Behind those cold, calculating blue eyes, there didn't seem to be any fear.
I guess because I, too, was once a foolish young girl captured by bad men.
What did they do to you?
The woman smiled a grim smile.
They made me into what I am, Mordsith. You wouldn't be that lucky. These men aren't anywhere near as good at what they do.
Beata had never heard of a Mordsith before. Their attention was drawn to Estelle's cries from up on the Dominie Dirch.
I need to go after the sword. I suggest you run.
Take me with you.
No, you cannot be of any use and will only hold me back.
Beata knew the awful truth of that.
What am I to do?
You get your behind out of here before those men get a hold of it, or you'll be very much more than sorry.
Please,
Beata said, tears welling up again.
Help me save Estelle and Emmeline.
The woman pressed her lips tight as she considered a moment.
That one,
the woman finally said, with cold reckoning, pointing at Estelle.
As I'm leaving, I'll help you get that one. Then it's up to you two to get away.
Beata saw the man laughing, groping Estelle's breasts as she tried to fight him. Beata knew what that was like.
But we have to get Emmeline, too.
She gestured off toward the barracks where they dragged her.
That one has a broken leg. You can't take her. She'll get you caught.
But she's...
Forget her. What are you going to do? Carry her? Stop being a fool, child. Think. Do you want to try to get away with that one, or do you want to get yourself captured for sure going after both? I'm in a hurry. Decide.
Beata struggled to breathe, wishing she couldn't hear the screams coming from the barracks. She didn't want to find herself in there with those men. She already had a taste of one of them.
The one, then. Let's go,
Beata said with finality.
Good for you, child.
The woman was deliberately calling her that, Beata knew, to put her in her place, hoping it would keep her in line and save her life.
Now, listen and do exactly what I say. I'm not sure you'll make it, but it's your only chance.
Desperate to escape the nightmare, Beata nodded.
I'm going to go up there and take out that man. I'll see to it you have at least two horses. I'll send the girl down while you grab the horses. Get her up on a horse with you, and then head out there and don't stop for anything.
The woman was pointing out past the Dominie Dirch, out to the wilds.
You just keep going, away from Andereth, to some other place in the Midlands.
How are you going to keep them from getting us?
Who said I was? You just get the horses, and then you two run for your lives. All I can do is try to give you a lead.
The woman held a finger before Beata's face.
If for any reason she doesn't make it down the steps or get on the horse, you leave her and run.
Beata, numb from terror, nodded. She just wanted to get away. She didn't care about anything else anymore. She just wanted to escape with her life. Beata clutched the red leather sleeve.
I'm Beata.
Good for you. Let's go.
The woman sprang up, running in a crouch. Beata followed after her, imitating her low run. The woman came up behind a soldier standing in their way and knocked his feet out from behind. As soon as he crashed to his back, before he could call out, she dropped on him, crushing his windpipe with a blow from her elbow. Two more quick blows silenced him.
How did you do that?
Beata asked, dumbfounded. She pushed Beata down in a thick clump of grass by the man.
Years of training in how to kill. It's my profession.
She checked the Dominie Dirch again.
Wait here until the count of 10, then follow. Don't count fast.
Without waiting for Beata's answer, she sprang into a dead run. Some men watched, confused by what was going on, since she wasn't trying to escape, but heading right for the center of all the men. The woman dodged between all the horses racing around the Dominie Dirch, their riders hooting and hollering. The man next to Beata was burbling blood from his crushed nose, maybe drowning in it as he lay there on his back. The man holding Estelle turned. The woman in red yanked the striker from the holder, tearing it away from the restraints. The restraints added momentum as they broke. When the striker clouted the man in the head, Beata could hear it crack his skull from where she stood as she finally reached the count of 10. He toppled backward over the rail and fell beneath the hooves of running horses. In the grip of terror, Beata jumped up and started running. The woman, with a mighty swing, brought the striker around, slamming the Dominie Dirch. The world shook with the dull drone of the weapon going off. The sound was overpowering, like it might shimmy her teeth out of their sockets and vibrate Beata's skull apart. The men on horseback out front screamed. Their horses screamed. The cries ended abruptly as man and beast alike came apart in a bloody blast. Men still running round the Dominie Dirch couldn't stop in time. They skidded or tumbled past the line to their death. Beata ran for all she was worth, even as she felt her joints might come apart from the terrible chime of the Dominie Dirch. Wielding the striker, the woman whacked men off their horses. She seized Estelle by her arm and practically threw her down the steps as Beata gathered the reins to two frightened animals. The men were in a state of confused panic. They didn't know what would happen with the weapon, if it would chime again and, in turn, kill them too. Beata snatched a confused, terrified Estelle by the arm. The woman in red leaped from the railing onto the back of a man still mounted. The woman still had the broken neck of the black bottle. She gripped the man around the middle and ground the broken bottle into his eyes. He fell screaming from his horse. She scooted forward into the saddle and snatched up the reins. She reached the tired animal she had arrived on, grabbed her saddlebags, and, with a cry of fury, urged her horse into a dead run toward Fairfield.
Up!
Beata screamed to a dazed and bewildered Estelle. Thankfully, the Ander woman understood her chance to escape and seized it as Beata, too, scrambled atop a horse. Both animals wheeled all about in the confusion. Men went charging off after the woman in red leather. Beata was no horsewoman, but she knew what she must do. She thumped her heels against the animal's ribs. Estelle did the same. The two of them, one Haken, one Ander, ran for their lives.
"Where are we going, Sergeant?" Estelle cried out.
Beata didn't even know what direction she was running. She was just running. She wanted the uniform off. It was just another cruel joke played on her by Bertrand Chanbour.
"I'm not a sergeant," Beata yelled back, tears streaming down her face. "I'm just Beata, a fool, same as you, Estelle."
She wished she had thanked the woman in red for saving their lives. Chapter 65. Dalton glanced up to see Hildemar gliding into his new office. She was wearing a revealing dress of a gold-colored satin with white trim, as if anyone would be all that interested in what she had to reveal. He rose behind his new expansive desk, the like of which he had never imagined would be his.
"Hildemar, what a pleasure to have you stop in for a visit."
She smiled as she peered at him like a hound eyeing a meal. She ambled around his desk to stand close beside him, leaning her bottom against the desk's edge so she could face him intimately.
"Dalton, you look marvelous in that outfit. New, must be," she said, running a finger down the embroidered sleeve. "You look good in his office, too. Better than my worthless husband ever looked. You bring it some class."
"Thank you, Hildemar. I must say you look ravishing yourself." Her smile widened. With true pleasure or in mockery, he wasn't sure. She had not been shy about expressing her admiration for him since the old sovereign unexpectedly passed on. On the other hand, he knew her well enough not to be lulled into turning his back on her, in a manner of speaking. He wasn't able to decide if she was being warm and friendly, or if she hid an executioner's axe behind her back. Either way, he was on guard.
"The vote is counted from the city, and beginning to come in from the returning soldiers."
Now he thought he knew the reason for her smile and the results of the people's say. Still, one could never be certain of such things.
"And how are the good people of Andereth responding to Lord Rawl's invitation to join with him?"
"I'm afraid Lord Rawl is no match for you, Dalton."
A tentative smile began to work its way up onto his face.
"Really? How convincing is it?
If it isn't a resounding rejection, Lord Rawl may feel he has cause to press his case." She shrugged in a teasing manner.
"The people of the city, of course, are reluctant to believe Lord Rawl. 7 of 10 gave him an X."
Dalton tipped his head up, closed his eyes, and let out a sigh of relief.
"Thank you, Hildemar," he said with a grin.
"And the rest?"
"Just starting to come in. It'll take the soldiers a time to ride back, but so far. How goes it so far?"
She dragged a finger around on the desktop.
"Surprising."
That confused him.
"Surprising? How so?"
She turned a beaming smile up at him.
"The worst for us is only 3 in 4 votes our way. Some places have had as many as 8 and 9 in 10, giving Lord Rawl an X."
Dalton put a hand to his chest as he let out another sigh of relief.
"I thought as much, but one can never know for sure on such things."
"Simply amazing, Dalton. You are a wonder."
She turned her palms up. And you didn't even have to cheat. Imagine that.
Dalton made two fists of excitement. Thank you, Hildemar. Thank you for bringing me the news. If you'll excuse me, I must go straight away and tell Teresa. I've been so busy, I've hardly seen her for weeks. She'll be so glad to hear the news. He started to move, but Hildemar put a restraining finger to his chest. Her smile had that deadly edge to it again.
Teresa already knows, I'm sure.
Dalton frowned. Who would have told her before I was told?
Bertrand told her, I'm sure.
Bertrand? What would he be doing telling Teresa news like this? Hildemar made a little simper.
Oh, you know how Bertrand talks when he's between the legs of a woman he finds thrilling.
Dalton froze. Alarm bells chimed in his head as he began recalling all the times he had been absent from Teresa since Bertrand had been named Sovereign, recalling how taken Teresa was with the figure of Sovereign. He recalled how she had spent the night up in prayer after meeting the old Sovereign. He recalled her awe at Bertrand becoming Sovereign. He made himself stop speculating in such a fashion. Such speculation was an insidious enemy that could eat you away from inside. Hildemar, knowing how busy he had been, was probably just hoping to give him a fright or cause trouble that would be like her. That isn't the least bit amusing, Hildemar. Propping one hand on the desk, she leaned toward him and ran a finger of the other hand down his jaw.
Not meant to be.
Dalton stood silent, carefully trying to keep from making the wrong move before he knew what was really going on. This could still be a foolish trick of hers just to make him angry at Tess, thinking it would somehow drive him into her own arms, or it could be nothing more than news she misunderstood. He knew, though, that Hildemar was not likely to get news like this wrong. She had her own sources, and they were as reliable as Dalton's. Hildemar, I don't think you should be repeating slanderous rumors.
Not a rumor, my dear Dalton. A fact. I've seen your good wife coming from his room.
You know, Teresa, she likes to pray.
I've overheard Bertrand brag to Stein about having her.
Dalton nearly staggered back.
What?
The smirk spread in deadly perfection.
Apparently, from what Bertrand tells Stein, she is quite the unrestrained courtesan, and enjoys being a very bad little girl in his bed.
Dalton felt the blood go to his face in a hot rush. He considered killing Hildemar where she stood. As his finger touched the hilt of his sword, he considered it very seriously. Finally, instead, he kept himself under control, although he could feel his knees trembling.
I just thought you should know, Dalton, she added. I found it quite sad. My husband is humping your wife, and you don't know anything about it. It could be awkward. You could inadvertently embarrass yourself not knowing.
Why, Hildemar? He managed to ask in a whisper. Why would you get so much satisfaction from this? At last her smile bloomed into true pleasure.
Because I always hated your smug superiority about your vows of fidelity, the way you looked down your nose, believing yourself and your wife better than all the rest of us.
By sheer force of will, Dalton restrained himself. In times of trial or exigency, he was always able to become analytical in order to apply the best solution to the situation that confronted him. With a ruthless resolve, he did that now. Thank you for the information, Hildemar. It could indeed have been embarrassing.
Do me a favor, and don't go all gloomy about it, Dalton. You have reason to be enormously pleased. This is the Sovereign we're talking about. It is, after all, an honor for any man to provide his wife for as reverend and sublime a figure as the Sovereign of Andorith. You will be loved and respected all the more because your wife is giving the Sovereign release from the stresses of his high calling. You should know that, Dalton. After all, you made the man who he is, the Creator's advisor in this world. Your wife is simply being a loyal subject.
She chuckled.
Very loyal, from what I've overheard. My, but it would take quite the woman to match her.
She leaned close and kissed his ear.
But I'd like to try, Dalton, dear.
She looked him in the eye as she straightened.
I've always been fascinated by you. You are the most devious, dangerous man I've ever met. And I've met some real pieces of work.
She turned back from the doorway.
After you come to accept it, you will find it of no importance, Dalton, you'll see. And then,
as you suggested to me before. Once your vow is broken, I will be the first you come to. Don't forget, you promised.
Dalton stood alone in his office, his mind racing, thinking on what he should do. Kaylin laid her arms on his shoulders and leaned over, putting her cheek against his ear. It felt warm and comforting, despite the unneeded distraction. She kissed his temple.
How's it going?
Richard stretched with a yawn. Where did one begin? This man was bent seriously out of straight.
What do you mean?
I still have a lot to translate, but I'm beginning to get a picture of what happened. Richard rubbed his eyes. The man is sent here to banish the chimes. He at once scrutinizes the problem and sees a simple solution. The wizards at the keep thought it was inspired genius and told him so.
He must have been proud, she said,
clearly meaning the opposite. He understood her sardonic tone and shared the sentiment. You're right, not Joseph Ander. He doesn't say it here, but from what we've read before, I know the way he thinks. Joseph Ander would have felt not pride in himself for understanding it, but contempt for those who had failed to.
So, she said, he had the solution. Then what?
They told him to see to it at once. Apparently they were having problems similar to ours with the chimes, and wanted the threat ended immediately. He complained that if they had the good sense to send him to see to it, then they should stop telling him what to do.
Not a good way to treat his superiors at the keep.
They implored him to stop the chimes because of the people dying. Apparently they knew him well enough to realize they had better not threaten the man, at least not with the rest of the war to worry about. So they told him to use his best judgment, but to please hurry with a solution, so people would be safe from the threat. He was much more pleased to get such a message, but used it as a club to start lecturing the wizards at the keep.
About what?
Richard ran his fingers back into his hair. It was frustrating to try to put into words what Joseph Ander was about.
There's a lot left in here to translate. It's slow going. But I don't think this book is going to tell us how to banish the chimes. Joseph Ander just doesn't think that way, to write it down.
Kaylin straightened and turned around with her back to the table so she could stand facing him. She folded her arms.
All right, Richard, I know you better than that. What aren't you telling me?
Richard stood and turned his back to her as he pressed his fingers to his temple.
Richard, don't you trust me?
He turned to her. He took up her hand.
No, it isn't that. It's just that some of the things he says, I don't know where truth leaves off and Joseph Ander's madness begins. This goes beyond anything I've ever heard about, been taught, or believed about magic.
Now she did look concerned. He guessed in one way he was raising her fears wrongly. On the other hand, he couldn't begin to raise them to the levels of his own fears.
Joseph Ander, he began, thought he was just better than the other wizards.
We already knew that.
Yes, but he may have been right.
What? Sometimes in madness resides genius.
Kaylin, I don't know where to draw the line.
In one way, not knowing about magic is a liability. But in another, it means I'm not burdened by preconceived notions, the way the wizards at the keep were. So I might recognize the truth in his words where they did not. You see, Joseph Ander viewed magic not so much as a set of requirements. You know, a pinch of this, this word three times while turning round on your left foot and all that kind of thing. He saw magic as an art form, a means of expression.
Kaylin was frowning. I don't follow.
Either you cast a spell properly to invoke it, or it doesn't work. Like I call my power with a touch. Like the way we called the chimes by fulfilling specific requirements of the magic, thereby releasing it.
He knew that with her magical ability, her background, and her learning about magic, she would have the same problem the other wizards did.
Richard felt just a trace of the frustration Joseph Ander must have felt. In that, too, he understood the man that much better. Understood a tiny bit of the frustration of having people tell you the hard facts of something when you knew better, yet couldn't get them to see the abstract concept of the greater whole right before them. As did Joseph Ander, Richard thought to try again.
Yes, I know, and I'm not saying that doesn't work, but he believed there was more, that magic could be taken to a higher level, to a plane beyond that which most people with the gift used.
Now she really was frowning.
Richard, that's madness.
No, I don't think so. He picked up the journey book. This is in answer to something unrelated, they ask, but you have to hear this to understand the way Joseph Ander thinks. He read to her the crux of the translation. A wizard who cannot truly destroy cannot truly create. Richard tapped the book. He was talking about a wizard like the gifted now, a wizard with only the additive, like Zed. Ander didn't even consider a man to have the gift if he didn't have both sides. He thought of such a man as simply an aberration and hopelessly disadvantaged. Richard went back to the journey book and read on. A wizard must know himself, or he risks working ill magic that harms his own free will. That's him talking about the creative aspects of magic beyond the structure of it. Magic intensifies and concentrates passions, strengthening not only such things as joy, but ruinous passions too, and in this way they may become obsessions and unbearable unless released. Sounds like he's trying to justify being destructive, she said. I don't think so. I think he's onto something important, a higher balance, as it were. Kaelin shook her head, clearly not catching what he saw, but he could think of no way to get it across to her, so he read on. This is important. Imagination is what makes a great wizard, for with it he is able to transcend the limitations of tradition and go beyond the structure of what now exists into the higher realm of creating the very fabric of magic. That's what you were talking about? About him thinking of it as an art form? A means of expression, like he's the creator himself, weaving a cloth of magic out of nothing? Exactly. But listen to this. This, I believe, may be the most important thing Joseph Ander has to say. When the chimes ceased being a problem, the other wizards cautiously asked what he did. You can almost read the anxiety in their words. This is his terse reply to the question of what he had done to the chimes. A grace might rise in obedience to an inventive spell. Kaelin rubbed her arms, clearly disturbed by the answer. Dear spirits, what does that mean? Richard leaned close to her. I think it means he dreamed up something, a new magic, outside the parameters of the original conjuring that brought the chimes into this world. Magic to suit the situation and himself. In other words, Joseph Ander got creative. Kaelin's green eyes cast about. He knew she was considering the depths of aberration with which they were dealing. This was the madman who had finally inflicted the chimes on them. The world is coming apart, she whispered to herself. And you're talking about Joseph Ander using magic as an art form? I'm just telling you what the man said. Richard turned to the last page. I skipped ahead. I wanted to see the last thing he wrote the wizards. Richard studied the high Daharan words again to be certain of the translation and then read Joseph Ander's words. In the end, I have concluded I must reject the creator and the keeper both. I instead create my own solution, my own rebirth and death, and in so doing will always protect my people. And so farewell, for I shall lay my soul on troubled waters, and thus watch over for all time that which I have so carefully wrought, and which is now safeguarded and inviolate. Richard looked up. See? Do you understand? He saw she didn't. Kaelin, I don't think he banished the chimes as he was supposed to. I think he instead used them for his own purposes. Her nose wrinkled. Use them? What can you use the chimes for? The Domini Dirge. What? She squeezed the bridge of her nose between her fingers and thumb. But then how was it possible for us to follow such a well-defined, prescribed, strict outline and inadvertently call them forth? That sort of structure is exactly what you are telling me Joseph Ander thought he was beyond. Richard had been waiting for that exact argument. That's the balance. Don't you see? Magic must be balanced. In order to do something creative, he had to balance it with something not creative, a very strict formula. That it is so strict in its requirements to free the chimes is in itself proof of the creativity of what he did. He knew her well enough to tell she didn't agree, but wasn't in the mood to argue. She said simply, So how do we then banish the chimes? Richard shook his head with defeat in that much of it. I don't know. I fear there is no answer to that question. The wizards of Joseph Ander's time were equally frustrated and beaten by the man. In the end, they simply considered this place lost to them. I'm beginning to believe Joseph Ander created an unbreakable magic inside a puzzle without a solution. Kaelin took the book from his hands, closed it, and placed it back on the little table.
Richard, I think you're getting a little crazy yourself, reading the rantings of a lunatic. That's not the way magic works. That's what the wizards at the keep had told Ander, that he couldn't convert and control an element that was innately uncontrollable. Richard didn't tell Keelan that, though. She wasn't prepared to think of magic in those terms. Neither were the other wizards. Joseph Ander had not been at all pleased to have his ideas so summarily dismissed, thus his final farewell. Keelan put her arms around his neck.
I'm sorry. I know you're trying your best. I'm just getting nervous. The vote should be coming back soon.
Richard put his hands on her waist. Keelan, people will see the truth. They have to. She gazed off.
Richard, she whispered. Make love to me.
What? She looked up into his eyes.
It's been so long. Make love to me.
Here, now?
We can tie the tent shut. No one comes in without asking permission anyway.
She smiled.
I promise to be quiet and not to embarrass you.
With a finger, she lifted his chin.
I promise I won't even tell your other wife.
That brought a brief smile, but Richard wasn't able to keep hold of it.
Kaylin, we can't. Well, I think I could. I bet I could change your mind, too.
Richard lifted a small dark stone on her necklace.
Kaylin, magic has failed. This won't work. I know. That's why I want to.
She clutched at his shirt.
Richard, I don't care. What if we make a baby? So what?
You know, so what.
Richard, would it be so bad? Really?
Her green eyes were filling with tears.
Would it be so bad if we made a child together?
No, no, of course not, Keelan. It isn't that. You know I want to. But we can't right now. We can't afford to see Shoda in every shadow, waiting to do as she promised. We can't afford the distraction from our duty.
Our duty. What about us?
What about what we want? Richard turned away.
Kaylin, do you really want to bring a child into this world?
Do you want to bring a child into the madness of this world, the madness of the chimes and a horrific war looming before us?
What if I said yes?
He turned back to her and smiled. He could see he was only upsetting her. Dushalu being pregnant was probably making Kaylin think of having her own child.
Kaylin, I want to if you do.
All right?
Whenever you want, we will, and I'll deal with Shota. But in the meantime, could we wait until we see if there is even going to be a world of life, or even a world of freedom, into which we can bring our child?
She finally smiled.
Of course, you're right, Richard. I guess I was just getting carried away. We have the chimes to deal with, and the Imperial Order.
Richard took her in his arms to comfort her when Captain Myford called from outside the tent.
See, he whispered to her. She smiled.
Yes, Captain, come on in.
The man stepped inside reluctantly. He wouldn't meet Richard's gaze.
What is it, Captain? Lord Rawl, Mother Confessor. The vote in Fairfield is counted. Some of our men have returned with numbers, but not all of them, he was quick to add. There are more yet to come back. It will take a few days yet before they all travel back.
So, Captain, what are the results? The man handed over a slip of paper. Richard read it, but it took a moment for it to sink in.
7 in 10 against us, he whispered.
Kaylin gently lifted the paper from his fingers and looked at it. Without a word, she set it on the table.
All right, he said. We know they were telling all those lies in the city. We just have to realize it will be different out around the land.
Richard, Kaylin whispered, they will spread the same lies around the land.
But we talked to those people. We spent time with them.
Richard turned to Captain Myford.
What about the outlying places?
Well,
what about that place?
Richard snapped his fingers.
Westbrook, where we spent time looking at Joseph Anders' things. What about Westbrook? Is the boat back from there?
Man had backed away a step.
Yes, Lord Rawl.
And what is it then?
Keelan put a hand on his arm.
Richard, she whispered. The captain is on our side.
Richard pressed his fingers to his temples as he took a breath.
What is the vote from Westbrook, Captain?
The man, having lost much of his color, cleared his throat.
9 of 10 marked an X against us, Lord Rawl.
Richard stood stunned. He had talked to those people. He remembered some of their names, their beautiful children.
Richard felt as if the ground had disappeared out from beneath his feet, and he was falling through insanity. He had been up day and night trying to help these people have their own way over their lives, have freedom, and they rejected it. "Richard," Helen said in soft sympathy, "it was nothing you did. They told those people lies. They frightened the people." Richard lifted a hand in a vague manner. "But I talked to them, explained to them that this was for them, for their future, for the freedom of their children." "I know, Richard."
Captain Myford stood awkwardly. Kalin signaled with a hand, dismissing him. He bowed and quietly backed out of the tent.
"I'm going for a walk," Richard whispered. "I need to be alone." He waved toward the blankets. "Just go on to bed without me."
Richard walked alone into the darkness.